This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today, we're going to start our show by reminding you that the second Sunday in the month is coming up, and that means at 5 o'clock Central, you can tune here, right here on Prairie Public, to listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're going to preview what is coming up this Sunday with Jack Russell Weinstein, the host. And Jack, your topic is, how do the arts contribute to capitalism and economic development? So why did you pick the topic?
I picked the topic because I found this book that was amazing called The Creative Wealth of Nations by this young guy who was a musician and a native Ugandan and now a public policy person. And it just brings up all of these incredible issues that they sound like economics, they sound like public policy, but they're really just about how we measure and how we think about what it means to be a wealthy human being.
Well, this fellow, Patrick Kabanda, is a Juilliard-trained musician who also studied at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. That's a kind of an unusual combination. What did his education prepare him for?
It sounds like everything. He was an organist and I think he grew up in pretty serious circumstances, and he got this international scholarship to go to Juilliard. He's an organist, but he plays a bunch of other instruments. He learned music by copying scores by hand, and he developed this love of classical music, but also this sense of responsibility towards traditional music and culture and all those sorts of things. And then he got involved in the United Nations and did some work for them, and it became this book. And what this book basically argues is that when we talk about international trade, we've ignored all of the creative products. We've ignored all of the dance and the art and the music, and not selling posters or selling CDs, but the exchange of knowledge and experience and culture, and that in order to really measure the wealth of nations, we have to include that as well.
Okay. So what are the philosophical questions that you explored with Patrick?
Well, the first and obvious one is what does it mean to be wealthy? What does it mean to be a rich nation? But we also talked about how creative people may think differently than, say, public policy wonks, right? We talked about what it means to be a leader, and maybe instead of thinking of a leader as a bureaucrat or a lawyer, maybe we can think of a leader as a piano player, someone who has to deal with issues with different kinds of touch. Do you play the keys heavy and obvious and powerful, or do you make more subtle strokes and play things a little more quietly? So we talked about what it meant to be leadership. We talked about what it means to have cultural exchange. We talked about how to value women's work and traditional women's work. And we talked about how to include that in our calculations. So again, it sounds like an economics discussion because we're talking about wealth and exchange and money. But what we're really talking about is how you measure and value what it means to be a full human being.
So let's explore that a little bit, because this is creativity as a form of critical thinking, right? The value of the arts as a component of education, the liberal arts, that kind of thing. Sometimes that's devalued.
It is, and it's really unfortunate because, as he talks about in the book and as other people do, think about the things that we think are important for a business world, right? The business life, right? You need teamwork. Well, what teaches teamwork better than being in a band, right? Of listening to each other and following each other and respecting each other's equality so that you don't step on other people's music. You think about fixing mistakes. Well, artists constantly make mistakes and fix them. You think about performing under pressure. What does a dancer do but practice and perfect their art while everyone is watching? When you look at things from an artistic perspective and when you look at things from a creative perspective, you are using all of your critical faculties. You are using your ability to see what has happened, what is happening, and what will happen, and balance all of those three things to make split-second decisions that affect not just you but everyone around you.
You know, I just by coincidence ran into a professor who teaches leadership courses at NDSU last night. And he was talking about coming to see a show that I was in that was a two-person play. And he asked the students who he brought with him, how many people
are collaborating on this production? And they said, well, two, obviously. And he said, no. There's a costume designer. There's a lighting designer. There's a set designer. There's a director. There's a sound engineer. You know, it's a collaborative process.
It's a tremendously collaborative process, and it's a collaborative process that makes a lot of people's work invisible to the naked eye, right? You don't think about the lighting designer. You don't think about the director, but you really don't think about the dramaturge, the person whose job it is to give everyone the history of this particular topic, or the researchers who give background. The best art is art that feels inevitable, that in retrospect, it was a surprise when it happened, but in retrospect, you think it couldn't have happened any other way. And that takes massive amounts of learning, of practice, of concentration. So you go before a performance and you hear someone play. It's not 10 minutes worth of work. It's a lifetime worth of work in 10 minutes. And how is it that we have taken that idea and devalued it to such an extent that really all we think is that a musician is worth the amount of CDs they sell, or a painter is worth the amount of money that the painting gets sold for? That's such a, to use an economic term, impoverished idea of what it means to be wealthy.
Well, I know your dad is a jazz artist.
That's right.
But artists often are confronted with this conundrum where people say, I've got a show that I think you should do, a performance or a play I should maybe act in. I don't have any money, but I know you'll like the role.
Well, and there is a fundamental difference between an artist and, let's say, a CEO. And I'm generalizing here, but a CEO does something because the CEO wants to make a lot of money, right? An artist does something because the artist loves art, because the artist wants to create. And most artists will do art for free because they love the art. The problem is you have to eat. The problem is you have to pay rent. The problem is there are these things called intellectual property rights. And so the goal is to try to balance these two things out. We're not saying that every artist, that every actor, that every dancer should be a billionaire. But we are saying that in order to do the things you love, there should be enough support and enough recognition to provide people with the means to do that. Okay, you want to live the artistic life and you're willing not to pursue the riches. You shouldn't be punished with poverty for that.
We're talking with Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which will be heard this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public's radio network. The topic, How Do the Arts Contribute to Capitalism and Economic Development? His guest is Patrick Kubanda, the author of The Creative Wealth of Nations. How do you attach value in a capitalist economy to the intangible social rewards of the arts?
Well, let's think about it in a couple different ways. So one of Patrick's examples is someone goes to Nigeria to learn traditional drumming. We have to count that as exchange. We don't usually – economists don't count that as an exchange because there's not a monetary value. It's not worth $24 or something like that. But – when you talk about whether Nigeria is a worthwhile country, whether Nigeria should be considered an equal trading partner or an equal negotiating partner, you can say, well, look, Nigeria has all of this wealth, this opportunities to bring people, right? Tourism brings money. Someone going to learn traditional drums will spend money on hotels and spend money on food and buy crafts and all those sorts of things. But they also bring the Nigerian culture and the Nigerian learnings to the world. So instead of thinking of Nigeria in terms of email scams where they're trying to get all of our money, we can think of Nigeria as this rich place where you can get just the full human experience. The same thing in Haiti. We spent a bit of time talking about Haiti, where we tend to think of Haiti in terms of disaster relief and in terms of tremendous poverty. But there's incredible art and craftsmanship in Haiti. Why wouldn't we want a Haitian shoe that is handmade out of this tremendous tradition than a French shoe just because 150 years ago that's where the best fashions come from, right? He actually spent some time talking about nation branding. And so part of what we have to do in order to value these creative economies more is by branding them as positive rather than negative.
Well, art and creativity, though, are also benchmarks of human progress. We got cave paintings. We've got the Louvre as a collection of wonderful art. We've got the movies these days that are internationally, you know, seen. So we've made some progress, and we measure it in a sense by the arts.
That's absolutely true. And he tells a story in the book that I had never – this was really an insightful part. He talks about Pythagoras, who we all know from the Pythagorean theorem. And what I've talked about in the past and what some people may know is that the Greeks used music to teach math, to really understand ratios. But
well, mathematicians and music kind of go together.
That's
always
right.
Have.
And what he points out is that that Greek moment of Pythagoras was the first time we ever decided to use math to explain the natural world. Well, now we think that math is the only way to explain the natural world. And so this notion of science and technology, right, STEM, science, technology, and math, right, engineering and math, that comes from music. And so it's not just the massive progress of the arts, you know, two-point perspective to three-point perspective to 3Ds to holograms, right? It's that we wouldn't have any scientific advancement if we hadn't had those musical insights.
Well, we also look at math as a form of pure logic, and physics as sort of an extension of that into almost creative logic, because we're looking around the corner.
That's absolutely right. And physics can be so beautiful, right? Not just looking at the molecular structure of things, but also many mathematicians and many physicians will look at a formula and think of them as sublime, as elegant formulas. And so part of the problem is that we tend to use these creative terms and these artistic terms when things are less important, and then use these economic terms when they're more important. And what Patrick wants us to do is see that these things go side by side, that they're intertwined, that it's not one or the other, and that when we talk again about wealth, we are talking about creative contributions and creative exchange, not just selling shoes.
You know, when I found out we'd be talking about this topic, I remembered something I read that was quite bittersweet a couple of weeks ago. It was in the form of Fargo Moorhead, and it was by Dana Del Valle, the president and CEO of the Arts Partnership. Mm-hmm. And they'd been writing these regular essays, if you will, about why it's important to support the arts. And this is what she said, because it was her final essay. Whether it's asking for increased funding, encouraging the business sector to consider that arts as an asset for employee attraction and retention, proving the measurable economic benefits of the arts or more, writing this column has been an absolute privilege and one that I have also taken very seriously. But the challenge to beating a drum is that it can start to sound the same no matter where or how you hit it.
That's right. And many people have heard us say the arts are important, the arts are important. How do you communicate that message differently? I think Patrick does a good job in his book, but I'll actually say it in a different way, that a way that I said it once before on the show, I think a few years ago. Every time we get a new president at UND, the president redesigns his office. It's always been a him. Redesigns his office. Every time we have a new administrator, they spend lots of money on fancy clothes and haircuts. That's art. You want your office to look a certain way. You want your fashion and your body to look a certain way. So even at the highest echelons of the University of North Dakota, of the President of the United States, art is always the first consideration. And so why shouldn't we give our school kids, why shouldn't we give the folks of Fargo Moorhead, why shouldn't we give everyone the same experience to think about, to cultivate, to immerse themselves in art and contribute public funds and private funds to make sure that everyone has access to that beauty, that personal representation, that ability to express themselves, not just the wealthiest, most powerful people.
You know, I've had the advantage of having some travel. I've been to Uganda, for example, and I've been to Bali. And these countries have these unique cultural experiences, and the art is very much there. I was reminded, because I was looking into this, the world's biggest statue right now is taking shape on a hill overlooking Bali's International Airport, 25 years and around $100 million in the making. It's an enormous copper and brass sculpture of the Hindu god Vishnu astride the mythical bird Garuda. They're spending $100 million. That would be $2 billion U.S. dollars for a statue.
And on the one hand, you think, well, there's all these other things that you can do with it. On the other hand, you think, what an incredible monument to religion, to love, to community, to make this statue because people should see it, right? One of the complications with this discussion is that creative products are both public goods and private goods. When we talk about economics, we talk about private property, right? Or we talk about public goods, government money and things like that. And when you have things that are mixed, that are both private and public, it makes it very hard to talk about economically. But all art is both private and public. It's a private creation of an individual or a group of individuals, but it is seen by, heard by, felt by, experienced by everyone who's in its vicinity. And why wouldn't you want to spend that much money so that everyone could see Vishnu? So everyone could see your God, your love, your creativity, the culmination of millennia of crafts traditions. Why wouldn't you spend your money on that?
How many people have gone to New York to see the Statue of Liberty
or to
Rapid City or outside Rapid City to see, you know, the four presidents at Mount Rushmore, that kind of thing?
Can you imagine talking about the United States without the Statue of Liberty? Can you imagine trying to describe what this country is without the history of that sculpture, which of course is what it is, and how powerful it is when they added that poem at the base, you know, bring us your poor, your hungry, your huddled masses, right? That phrase is incredibly important for the current immigration debate. So the Statue of Liberty isn't just something we look at. It's the meaning, it's the symbol, and it's a gathering place, and it's a way of negotiating who we are, and that's worth attending to.
Well, when we read novels, great novels, the great American novel or the great French novel or whatever, or we see a play that makes us think or a movie that explores an idea that, you know, people are maybe talking about but not out loud.
Right.
We're stretching the envelope a bit with the arts.
You know, I look at the world around us now. I look at the debates in the newspaper, the mass killings and all of that sort of stuff. But I also think about the internet and incredible artists and my connection with Patrick, who's from Uganda, or my friends in Iran. And I think it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, right? Mm-hmm. Charles Dickens was on to something. It is the best of times and it is the worst of times. Novels, poetry, language can communicate ideas and experiences that otherwise we could never do. One of my favorite moments in cinema is in the movie Contact, and Jodie Foster plays a scientist who goes to another world, right? And she's in space and she looks outside and she says, they should have sent a poet. And it's heartbreaking because, of course, what she's saying is you need a special language to describe the beauty and the sublime aspects of nature that she's seeing.
Well, we also, again, because we have these issues that are overarching that are now millennia old, like gender equity, the arts is a way to push that particular boundary.
That's absolutely right. And Patrick talks about this and we talk about it a little during the show, that women traditionally, what they've created doesn't get counted in the wealth of the nation. So a mother crochets a blanket for her child. That doesn't get counted in GDP. Why not? It's incredibly important. A woman makes a meal for her family, or a woman works in the black market and does laundry because she's not allowed outside of the house. These don't get counted in our gross domestic product. They don't get counted as exchange, and they should. And so these narrow economic definitions do more than limit the sort of the holistic notion of a human being. It also traps people, and women especially, into thinking they have no valuable skills, or it traps people into pushing them into being trapped. And so expanding the notion of what counts and expanding the notion of creation allows for us to think about putting the genders on an equal playing field.
Okay. Now, the question again for Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life this Sunday is How Do the Arts Contribute to Capitalism and Economic Development? We've talked about a number of different aspects there, but I'm sure Patrick has looked at this too. Patrick Kabanda, the author of The Creative Wealth of Nations. What are the metrics, inevitably the metrics, that he uses to measure progress?
So he does a couple different things. He looks at the traditional metrics to show us how intellectual property, how tourism, how music sales and things like that contribute to GDP. So he uses those traditional things. But he also says that the proper metric is not the amount or the size of the economy, but rather the potential of the economy. This goes back to – way back to Adam Smith, who argued that the wealth of a nation was not just the money in its borders but the amount of labor and the amount of things that a country can produce. What he is saying is, look, if you take a country like Uganda or Nigeria or Haiti and you include their creative elements, then all of a sudden they're significantly richer. And if they're significantly richer, then they're eligible for more loans from the World Trade Organization. They're eligible to be an equal trading partner when they're talking with the United States. So maybe we say, all right, in the United States, we're going to sell Haiti this many galoshes, right? But in return, we are going to accept or offer visas to this many guitarists or something like that. And so one of his central points is that we have to create artists' visas that make it easier for us to exchange artists so that artists can go to other countries, perform, earn money, but also teach. And so there you have ticket sales, you have t-shirt sales because it's the modern world, right? You have food sales. You have all of those things that come from performances, but you also have togetherness, you have peace, you have the sense that we're all in it together. And those things are not quantifiable, but they're the preconditions for a strong economy.
And the things that we call art are in essence an individual or individuals banding together to create something. And creativity distinguishes us. That's almost the human element, isn't it?
The most amazing thing about art, you see this with music, you see this with painting, you see this with drama, is you've created something out of nothing. There is nothing else in the world other than art where you create something out of nothing. That in itself needs to be celebrated because that is the divine working in on us. That now, Patrick doesn't say that, but I say that. Art is the divine working in us. We are creating in the most literal sense of creation, something out of nothing, just like God did the first 6 days.
So this is a pretty rich topic. How do the arts contribute to capitalism and economic development? Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public's radio network. Jack, always a fair amount of food for thought here. Thanks for the feast today.
It's always a pleasure to eat with you.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, as we do every Friday, about the big stories of the week. And Matt Olin will be in to review a brand new movie. This time, it's The Last Black Man in San Francisco. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. As you drive by Ray Richards' golf course in Grand Forks, it looks like the only thing missing is golfers. The University of North Dakota is in the process of trying to reopen the course that was shuttered after the 2016 season. UND spokesman David Dodds, says a lot of work has gone into getting the course back into playing shape. Dodds says the greens have been seeded, the fairways are being mowed, and the rest is up to Mother Nature.
There's only two undefeateds in this world, and that's Father Time and Mother Nature. And in this case, we're really relying on Mother Nature to give us lots of sunshine and lots of rain, but not too much of either.
Dodd says the hope is to be able to open the course in a few weeks, for a few weeks in October, and then have things ready for the full season in 2020. Dilworth, Minnesota Police Chief Ty Sharp has asked a cell phone provider for information on the subscriber who placed a call reporting that a man with a gun was in Walmart yesterday afternoon. Sharp says the investigation has so far determined that a 911 call came from a phone that was in the store or on the property. It was not from a 701 or 218 area code. He says Walmart continues to check surveillance video in the hopes of identifying a suspect. The caller claimed that two men were arguing in the paint aisle and that one of them had a gun. The store was evacuated for about 15 minutes until it was clear that there was no threat. And a suspect in the murders of four people at a Mandan property management firm has waived his preliminary hearing. 44-year-old Chad Isaac of Washburn was accused of the April 1st shooting and stabbing deaths of RJR property management owner Rob Falker, RJR employees Adam Fuhrer, and Bill and Louise Cobb at the company's main office. A preliminary hearing had been scheduled Monday, but Isaac waived the right to a preliminary hearing and has entered a not guilty plea. A trial date has yet to be scheduled. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This week on the show, a special vocal performance from our quiz guy, John Chinesky.
I must be a silly bird to come up with a silly quiz. A quiz like this. Soon I'll be extinct.
That is awesome.
This is a topic dear to my heart.
Join us this week on Away with Words.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Well, there's that old wire machine in the background, and at least two of us in the state know what that means.
Yeah, you're right.
We started our careers listening to that chatter in the back of the newsrooms, and Dave, you join us every week, Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, to talk about the week's news stories. And a big story in North Dakota and everywhere in the country and around the world right now is these shootings that seem to keep taking place. That reminded me that in the legislative session that ended, you know, months ago now, a red flag law was debated briefly but lost.
Right, and that was Carla Rose Hansen from Fargo, a Democratic representative who brought the idea up, and she had Republican co-sponsors on it too. And it was basically if you suspect that somebody may be going off the wheels and may be prone to using guns for these kind of purposes, you can go to a judge and get a temporary restraining order, and you can confiscate guns temporarily until you can figure out what the person's state of mind is.
So this might come up again.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, it's been talked about now a lot more since the shootings have happened, the national shootings that we've been talking about. And Representative Hansen may try again in the legislature coming up in 2021.
Well, one of those incidents was a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, where 22 people were killed and many others wounded. Recently, just yesterday, there was a 911 gun report of somebody at the Dilworth Walmart east of Moorhead.
But nobody found anybody, from what I understand, in reading through some of the reports. No gun was found. Walmart was emptied for about 15 minutes, and then people were allowed to go back in.
But we're reminded just how sensitive this issue is now. You know, people might see things that aren't there and whatever. And then just this morning, there was a man in body armor armed with a rifle taking cell phone video of himself as he pushed a cart through a Walmart in Missouri. He was arrested.
Right. And he was arrested before he could do any damage or anything like that.
Well, and as you reminded me, there was a serious shooting incident, a quadruple homicide in Mandan.
That's right. This thing happened at RJR Properties, and that happened on April 1st. Four people died, including the owner and three employees. Well, there was a preliminary hearing that was scheduled Monday, but the suspect in the case, Chad Isaac, he's from Washburn, he's 44, and he's a chiropractor up there. He's now waived his right to a preliminary hearing and has entered a not guilty plea. Next, there will be a trial date set.
Okay. So guns. Right.
That's right.
A story by Blake Nicholson in the Bismarck Tribune caught my eye. This was published yesterday. The headline, Burgum Campaign Measures Popularity Against That of Heitkamp. Apparently, they've been doing some polling and they used her name.
I think they have, because there has been a lot of whispers that
There's a lot of Democrats who are trying to convince Heidi Heitkamp to run for governor again. She's basically said, no, she's not interested in running for governor, so I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, if you want to judge your popularity, you might have that might be a good way to judge popularity to find out if you are actually going to run for re-election.
I don't quite understand why, you know, prominent politicians who are successful in an office, and Governor Burgum has some popularity. It's a Republican state. Why keep saying he's leaning in to run for re-election?
Yeah, I think he's being cautious because, you know, something might happen. It's pretty far out in terms of announcing, but hey, you know, things will start probably shaking out a little bit this fall.
Well, Democratic NPL Chairwoman Kylie Overson has said, and she was cited in the story as having asked Heitkamp if she was interested in running for governor. She said she's pretty adamant about not being interested. But Overson also said that Burgum does have a little pushback among his own party in the legislature.
Well, there is. There's one group called the Bastiat Caucus who is not really enamored with him. And there are some who kind of wonder about where he's going with his with some of the initiatives there. When it comes right down to it, though, the rank and file of Republicans will get behind him.
Okay. Let's move on to another issue because you just reported, yesterday that the North Dakota Ethics Commission has been appointed.
Right. We have five members, and what's going to happen is they'll take office effective September 1. They'll get together. They'll start meeting, and one of the big tasks they have to do is write some of the administrative rules that will be the committee's going to take a look at, and also to implement the ethics legislation and the ethics initiated measure that was passed by voters.
Now, that's sort of the devil's always in the details, isn't it?
Right. And it's going to take a little time to get that done because it is a huge subject in terms of, you know, what is ethical, what is not, what are you allowed to do if you're a lobbyist, what are you not allowed to do, or as a lawmaker, as an elected official. There are going to be a lot of do's and don'ts that are going to have to be codified somewhere.
And this group has been described as essentially nonpartisan. They're not lobbyists,
yes,
and all that kind of thing.
It's an impressive group. You know, you've got the ex-mayor of Williston, Ward Cozier, who I've known for a while, and he's really well thought of.
Mm-hmm.
You have a former general from the North Dakota National Guard who's very well thought of. You have the president of that tribal college at Fort Totten, and she's very well thought of. I mean, these are good folks.
And Paul Richard of Fargo, who used to be with Sanford Health,
right,
is very well known in this part of the state. And
yep.
Ron Goodman is a former judge from Oaks. So
right.
Lots of, I guess, prominent people in the sense that they're doing something pretty important, at least. Finally, the Ethics Commission has been formed and will get to work one of these days.
Right. Now, there were 69 people who applied for the job. Governor Burgum said at the end of this meeting that he was a little bit disappointed that we didn't see more women apply because only about a quarter of the people who applied are women. And he didn't see many young people, but he's hoping that maybe once the commission gets rolling and then gets an idea about direction, maybe we'll get a bigger pool and a better pool of candidates.
And
he was not disparaging the candidates that were selected. He was just saying that, you know, he'd like to see a more diversified pool.
Well, there's one woman on those among those five, and they're
right.
They have 4-year terms. The full term is 4 years, so
right.
There will be turnover.
Oh yes.
You also reported just a few hours ago that the next medical marijuana dispensary will open in Bismarck.
Right. That's the newest one. That's the number 4, and there are other dispensaries being planned. And what it sounds like is the next one to open will be in Jamestown.
So 8 total?
There's going to be 8 total, and there are still just 2 growth centers. And what I found interesting in talking to Jason Wall at the health department is that of the 2 growth centers, both are growing product, one in Bismarck, one in Fargo. But right now, only Bismarck is actually shipping medical marijuana to dispensaries.
Hmm.
Fargo still has some work to do to get it up and running.
Well, there are only 916 card-carrying patients at this point, so.
Right, but the feeling is that once you get more dispensaries and dispensaries that are close to patients, you will see that number go up.
Okay. Earlier this week, Todd McDonald reported that the operators of the Dakota Access Pipeline want to expand that pumping capacity considerably. I think they want
right.
to almost double it, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they want to double it. It's going to go to 1.1 million barrels potentially. to do that, they're not going to be putting any more pipe in the ground, but they're adding more compressor stations. They will be added in Emmons County. Well, this may reopen hearings on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and there are certain groups, environmental groups and Native American groups, who want the Public Service Commission to have full hearings on the expansion of the pipeline because they worried that oil might leak into the Missouri because it was the pipeline goes under the Missouri. And if you put in more oil, they're arguing that there might be more leakage. What Dakota Access argues is with new compressors, you're not going to see much more of any risk of leakage.
Okay. But if you expand the capacity, you double it, a leak will be twice as big, won't it?
Could possibly be, yes.
Okay. There's a federal lawsuit over a Mandan mural. That really caught my eye.
At the Lonesome Dove.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, this is the business putting a mural on the side of their business, right?
That is right. And Mandan has an ordinance saying you have to get these things approved before you put them up. And the owners of the Lonesome Dove went ahead and put it up, and there was an objection because the name of the business is in the mural. And they're saying that does not fit in with our historical Mandan aura we're trying to put together for the city. So the owners of the Lonesome Dove have filed a federal lawsuit, and their First Amendment rights.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, different cities can have different opinions, I guess, about this kind of public art.
Right.
And Fargo's getting covered with murals these days.
Right. And Bismarck is starting to as well. We're seeing that too.
All right. Well, let's – because, you know, we always talk in front of Matt O'Lean where he talks about the newest movie out there. Let's get the previews of coming attractions in the news business.
What I'm going to be watching next week is there's a big meeting of all the school districts in Williams County because – a couple of the districts, District 1, which is the city of Williston, District H, which is outside the city of Williston, have tried for bond issues to build some new schools. They've failed. There seems to be an overcrowding problem, and 1 and 8 don't get along so well.
Hmm.
So there's a meeting that Governor Burgum and Superintendent Baszler have called to get the school districts together to try to work out some solutions to, you know, find some more space, find some more teachers, et cetera.
Well, schools are expensive.
They certainly are.
Well, anything else?
There are a couple of interim committees that are going to meet. Commerce is going to be taking a look at some things. And I know that the health department has got the health council meeting. And remember that whole kerfuffle over cottage foods and what's allowed and what isn't allowed?
Yes.
That's going to be discussed at that meeting too. So there's going to be a few things next week. So, you know, summer is starting to ebb a little bit. You know, even though the calendar says we still have a lot of summer left, but interim committees are getting going and some things are starting to bubble to the surface again.
Well, we check in with our news director every week, Dave Thompson. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, sir.
So you and your brain have a kind of quiet agreement to just get along.
Yeah, but every so often you and your brain fall out of agreement.
My face started to feel a little bit strange.
I felt the floor sort of shake.
I couldn't move.
The premonition that something's about to happen. And then boom.
When brains attack on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we continue a conversation from last week and talk about Jefferson and religion.
Jefferson was a very private man. He did not divulge his religious views happily because he knew that his views were more radical than most Americans were willing to accept in his era.
Yes, so they got him in trouble more than once.
Well, in Notes on Virginia, which he expected to be privately circulated and never published, he said, "Whether you believe in one God or 20, neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." And he paid for that for the rest of his life from evangelicals who thought that that was the statement of a very dangerous man.
And we also talked about your upcoming Lewis and Clark trip, sir.
The trip of trips every year, I get to take 10 days on the Lewis and Clark Trail, 3 days on the wild and scenic Missouri River and the White Cliffs, and then 3 days up in the Lolo Trail west of Missoula. It is paradise on earth.
Join us on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies again with Matt Olien, another new movie this week, a title I've heard, but I don't know much about the film, Matt, The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Yeah, so this is now in limited release. It got an opening in the major cities first. Now it's starting to get out here into the Midwest to us, and I saw it recently at the Fargo Theater. It is a semi-autobiographical portrait of Jimmy Fails, who is the actor, the lead actor in the film, who plays Jimmy Fails. He plays himself. It's based on kind of a story of his family growing up in a house similar to the house that's portrayed in the film. Now, the house is in San Francisco. It's a very stately-looking older house that Fails claims his grandfather built in 1946, and the family apparently used to live in this house. So that's what the film's about. Director Joe Talbot also knows Jimmy Fails in real life, and they kind of worked on this project together to get it made, crowdfunding, things like that, and finally premiered at Sundance, and now it's out to the general public. The story centers around this house that Jimmy Fails' family grew up in and his attempts to kind of reclaim the house. He goes there, he paints the house, even though these two older people live there. He feels like a connection to this house because he grew up there, and they're okay with him like painting the windowsills and doing things, but they'd kind of like him to leave too because he doesn't really live there. That's what the film is about. It's really about gentrification. It's about the city of San Francisco. Having some knowledge of the city of San Francisco might help people with this film. There was a few parts I was like, what? You know, you're just a little bit lost in parts of the film. So I liked the film, didn't love it. A lot of critics are going really crazy over this film. The style of the film is very good. Talbot uses slow motion techniques, camera movement, a lot of interesting scenes, a lot of really bravura scenes that are really interesting to watch as he's running down the street or skateboarding or things like this. The criticisms I would have of the film were it doesn't quite reach the greatness level that I think it looks like it's something that could be a great film when you watch it. But I think what holds it back for me, and I'm an outlier on this, is there are too many characters that are underwritten. And there's too many scenes that start and don't go anywhere where I wanted them to. I needed more backstory on how this family ended up in this house. We have scenes with Jimmy and his father, played by Rob Morgan. I needed more backstory in the father. What is the conflict between he and his father, which is kind of hinted at and never really fleshed out? There's a scene on a subway where his mother shows up very randomly, and you're kind of like, where is this going? There's a character named Kofi in the film that you think is kind of a side supporting character, but he turns out to be an important character because of circumstances that happen. And what happens, Doug, is when characters are underwritten, like the Kofi character and the father, when the big scenes come, you're not emotionally invested because they are underwritten characters. I think that's one of the main problems I had with the film. But the style of the film is gorgeous. It's elegant. You can tell that Joe Talbot has talent behind the camera. He knows how to shoot a scene. He knows how to direct a scene. I just wanted the characters to be a little more fleshed out. The main characters of the film are Fails and then Jonathan Majors as his friend Montgomery Allen, who's a local playwright who's trying to write a play. And they kind of live in the house and they're squatters at the house. And those are some really good scenes as well. And you really feel that friendship between the two of them. But I wanted some more backstory throughout the film because the film is a little hard to follow. And if it was hard to follow for me, then I wonder if it's going to be hard to follow for, you know, general audiences. But overall, I liked it. People should see it. I just think some characters needed to be fleshed out better to achieve that emotional impact that you're waiting for.
Well, the name that in the cast that jumped out at me was Danny Glover. Mm-hmm. What does he do?
So he plays the grandfather of the Jonathan Majors character, and Jimmy Fails kind of lives at his house. He sort of lives there because he has no place to go, and then eventually Jimmy wants to live at the old house. The film almost comes off, Doug, like a fairy tale. It's sort of this fine line between reality and fantasy, and maybe that's what Talbot's going for, and maybe that's why some of the characters aren't as really well fleshed out as I wanted them to be, because it has a fairy tale aspect to it about gentrification, Fillmore Street, kind of the history of San Francisco, and also about family secrets and sometimes family lies that become that sort of become fact within a family, even though we're not sure if they really happened or not. That's a key component in this film that really does get fleshed out after a while.
I'm intrigued by the idea of this film, though, because it's somewhat autobiographical.
Yes, is that it the, is. That is my understanding.
So Jimmy Fails has written his story. He stars in his story, and this is sort of the way he wants to tell it, I take it.
Yes, and it's the way Talbot wants to direct it as well.
Now, gentrification, big, big issue in San Francisco, one of the most expensive places in the world to live right now because of, you know, all of the tech development around it. That's an issue everywhere, even in Fargo, for that matter. So how does it deal with the displacement of the people who used to be there and maybe need to be there to make a real community?
So that's the key to the film, is the gentrification, his willingness, his wanting to go back and live in that family home. And what are the secrets of that family home? When was it built? Was it really built when he says his grandfather built it, or was it built 100 years before that? Because it looks like it was built in like the 1860s. So I think the gentrification, that's the message Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails are going for. But I sometimes felt like it needed to be fleshed out more. We needed more backstory of how and why they were ever on Fillmore Street and why they're not on Fillmore Street now and why they want to get back. So that's touched on. But again, the father character, the Kofi character are not well written enough so that when the big scenes come involving these two characters, you're not invested enough to have the emotion. That's at least my experience from the film. A lot of my friends have liked it better than me. I think people should see it. It's stylistically a wonderful looking film, but I wasn't completely moved by it like I thought I might be.
Now, the
Does
title,
that make sense?
Yeah, but the title makes a statement too, The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Yeah, that title is important in the film. And there's even a line in the film where they talk about the first black man in San Francisco, referring to Jimmy Fails' grandfather. So these become metaphors. The titles become metaphors for gentrification, for Jimmy wanting to live in this house, whether he's a squatter or whether he can afford the house. That's another issue that pops up in the film. So, again, I urge people to see it. It just didn't quite hit that great level for me, checking the boxes that I felt it needed to be an Oscar contender or a great film. I think it's been compared to Moonlight a little bit from 3 years ago. Moonlight is the stronger film. But again, please look for this film. It's something you're not going to see. Look, I give them credit for having an original story. It's not a sequel. It's not a Disney sequel, which is what we said about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's an original story by Tarantino. So when you can find stories out there that aren't Disney sequels and comic book sequels and remakes, go see them, because at least someone is having an original thought out there.
All right. Well, I will go see this one. Thank you. And for my Oscar trivia question this week, I took the simple route. I went back. I picked an anniversary. 50 years ago this year, 1969, at the Academy Awards, who were the winners? Who was Best Actor?
So this is for the films released in 68?
Yes.
Okay. Cliff Robertson got Best Actor for Charlie. Do you want the other nominees?
Actor in a supporting
Jack
role.
Jack Albertson, the subject was Roses.
Actress?
That was the tie. The Katharine Hepburn, Lion in Winter, and Barbara Streisand for Funny Girl, there was a tie.
An unusual event. Actress in a supporting role.
That was Ruth Gordon in Rosemary's Baby.
Directing?
Carol Reed for Oliver.
Best Picture.
Oliver.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Happy anniversary.
After a week in which the last thing you want to do is talk about the news, tune into the show with the news that you want to talk about. We'll ask why you should be careful on the beaches, plus why you'll soon get where you want really quick, but with some windburn. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll be joined by the Fonz himself, Henry Winkler. Maybe he can bang on the world and make it work. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datepo for August 9th. A few days ago, listeners heard about the first citizens' military training camp in North Dakota at Fort Lincoln in 1928.
It was attended by 525 boys from North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska. On this date, they were settling in and making great use of the area. In preparing for the camp, the committee, set up by the Association of Commerce, was concerned about ways to entertain the boys for a whole month. F. H. Waldo, chair of the committee, said every resident of Bismarck will be asked to join hands as one big committee in working for the success of our first summer camp for boys. He added that the citizens of the area felt a personal pride in this establishment, for the residents of Bismarck have given both their moral and material support to the enterprise. Myra Natkinson made arrangements to allow the boys to use the municipal swimming pool, and transportation to and from was arranged by Frayne Baker. Dances were also planned, but since the number of boys was so large, these dances could only be attended by one company of boys at a time. Baseball games were played each evening, and volleyball was also on the agenda, as well as tennis, horseshoe pitching, track, and boxing, among other activities. Movies were arranged to be shown at the Post Gymnasium on Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday evenings. However, Army appropriations did not cover the full cost of the films, so a minimal admission fee was necessary. And apparently, all that still wasn't enough. An additional program of entertainment included band performances, mass singing, amateur stunts, readings, minstrel shows, boxing, and wrestling. A trip to the Badlands was considered, but instead, 300 of the youths headed off to Lake Isabel, packed into the cars of 60 Bismarck residents who had volunteered to transport the boys. Once at the lake, they enjoyed an Army dinner picnic, went swimming, and participated in athletic contests. Bismarck clearly made sure the boys had plenty of fun to balance out their studies. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Sarah Broom's memoir of her family's life in New Orleans revolves around a simple yellow house.
The house created such complexity of emotion for me. It was a repository of our memory. The house was a witness to our life.
Also, Latinos divided over Donald Trump, actress Michelle Williams on her new movie, and the latest news. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on our show, we'll talk with James Hogan, author of a book with an attention-getting title, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. Prairie Public's Scott Prebis will invite us to join him for Kansas City Jazz Meets Bismarck Jazz. Four of Kansas City's best will collaborate with Scott and Bismarck performers for a night of great jazz. And the New York Kammermusiker has been performing around the state, and on Tuesday, they'll be in Wahpeton to perform with Tal the Orangutan at the Chahinkapa Zoo. On Monday, we'll rebroadcast a story about Tal's fascination with the troupe and his own musical efforts. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we invite you to check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.